Welcome back to Between the Bar Lines. I'm your host, Dr. Maeve Berry. We only have two more episodes, including today, in season five. Thank you to everyone who has listened and shared this podcast with friends. If you have more people that you would like to share this with, feel free to share this podcast on social media or via email or at your family gatherings at upcoming holidays. I would really appreciate it. Thank you. Today, we are going to continue our chat about nationalism, but this time we will be focusing on American nationalism in the late 19th century. As the 1800s drew to a close, we know that Europe dominated classical music. We had the German conservatory training, all of the Italian vocal traditions that we learned about, and these huge French orchestral colors that set the standard. So naturally, Americans wanted to travel abroad to study from these people. And naturally, Europeans wanted to cross the sea to hold jobs in American orchestras, for example. But in the decades after the Civil War, a cultural shift began. Much like all of these other countries we've learned about thus far, we find now that Americans were increasingly interested in creating their own national identity. So music critics, composers, and audiences started pushing for a sound that was going to reflect America, these landscapes, stories, and different communities. But it proved to be very difficult because America was not very unique. And we know that even today, because as we approach the 250th anniversary of America, we really only have 250 years of these traditions that were backing up calling ourselves the United States of America. So, one of the first groups to tackle what nationalism was the so-called Second New England School. And we also know these people as the Boston Classicists. I believe when I was studying for all of my exams, this was a term that was new to me because these composers that I'm about to say are not very popular. I don't actually know if I've ever done any music by them. But these people were John Knollys Payne, George Whitefield Chadwick, and Horatio Parker. So these people wrote symphonies, overtures, and chamber music that were steeped in German Romanticism. But there are moments where American themes peek through. Specifically, Chadwick embraced folk elements and maritime imagery. But still, critics were debating on if this music was really authentically American because these were European-trained composers. But by the 1880s and 1890s, the conversation was intensifying around sources that represented America more broadly and authentically. So writers and ethnographers were collecting folk songs, spirituals, and melodies from African American, Native American, and immigrant communities. And these are what became the central aspect of the search for this American national music identity. And what's really interesting about this is it wasn't really an American that shaped this dialogue. It was actually Dvorak, a Czech composer, who was invited overseas to direct the National Conservatory of Music in New York. And there's a famous quote from him. This is taken directly from Dvorak in 1893, where he claimed, quote, "The future of music of this country must be founded upon what are called Negro melodies," end quote. So he encouraged his students to study spirituals and plantation songs and Native American material. And this is where we kind of get this symphony that sounds almost innately American. His Ninth Symphony, from the New World. And it was premiering this same year that he famously quoted that in 1893. And it's drawing upon all of these influences. Not quoting them directly, but basically putting them through a European sieve, so to say. And as you can imagine, this ignited a national argument. Some critics embraced the idea that African American and Native American music formed the roots of American style. And of course, as we know from history, others completely dismissed this due to prejudice. And I think that this debate highlights a larger truth about America as a whole. American music was profoundly, and is still profoundly, multicultural, even if at that time the classical establishment wasn't ready to acknowledge it. I think this is what makes American music so special. It's a whole conglomeration of so many different styles, yet we know American music when we hear it. So several composers in the late 19th century were beginning to weave all of these aspects together. The first was Edward McDowell, and he's often remembered as a musical poet of the American landscape. He has a famous piano piece called To a Wild Rose, and this really captures that pastoral nationalism and the reverence for the natural world, which really resonated deeply with American audiences. Though he was trained in Europe, he did seek to evoke the vastness and the majesty of the American environment. So his nationalism is on the more atmospheric, like pastoral side, rather than folkloric. We have Henry F. Gilbert, who was one of Dvorak's most, like you could say, big number one fangirl, okay? And his works were based on these African American and Native American themes. Two pieces I'd like to bring to mind that while I was studying, I didn't really ever hear about, was his comedy overture on Negro themes and The Dance in Place Congo. And these are really these early attempts to bring these traditions into symphonic form. So his work foreshadows later composers that we know of, like William Grant Still, but, you know, back in the 1890s, this was sparking controversy. Something cool about America at this point was nationalism wasn't just confined to concert halls, because we have some of the most powerful symbols coming out of more public spaces, the first of which is a composer named John Philip Sousa. He was known as the March King. We really know him for his patriotic marches, Stars and Stripes Forever, Semper Fidelis, pretty much any type of march you can think of, it might as well be Sousa. So this is a musical vocabulary that is instinctively American and kind of has that label of patriotism on it. His band traveled far and wide to play all of this music at parades, fairs, ceremonies, celebrations, you name it. Meanwhile, there were songwriters in New York that were producing popular songs that blended these ballads and these so-called quote-unquote minstrel-derived tunes and these ragtime influences. So innately, these songs were shaping the everyday lives of Americans and contributing yet another layer to this multifaceted and multicultural national identity, of a sense. From Tin Pan Alley, we have many prolific composers and lyricists like Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, George and Ira Gershwin, and we also have notable women like Dorothy Fields, and influential African-American composers like Scott Joplin. Now, by the close of the century, American music took on several different forms. We have several different forms of nationalism that I'm about to kind of wrap this episode up with. We have that environmental nationalism where we have MacDowell's music depicting landscapes of America. We have cultural nationalism, thanks to Dvorak and Gilbert and other composers drawing from African American and indigenous materials. We now in America have institutional nationalism. So this school was providing Americans with serious classical music and training now. And then we also have something that we can call popular nationalism. So the Sousa marches and the Tin Pan Alley songs that were reaching millions of people. So these threads together reveal that American national identity wasn't singular. We have this, as I said before, multifaceted, diverse nationalism. And it was a patchwork of borrowed forms and indigenous traditions and immigrant cultures and new popular idioms that were being created. So as you can see, late 19th century American music did not land on one definition of nationalism. And perhaps that could be the most American answer of all. Instead, we have these composers exploring so many different voices and traditions and dreams of what this new, still new, country could be by the end of that century. And in doing so, they were laying this groundwork for the absolute explosion of American music in the 20th century, where we have jazz and blues and modernism all the way until film scores. So it's pretty cool to kind of, you know, cross the sea and figure out what we're actually doing and what was actually happening in the late 19th century as a country that was not even 100 years old in some cases. With all this being said, we've finally reached the end of the 19th century and we are going into music of the 20th century. So we'll start a new season after the holidays. But I want to do one more episode just to kind of wrap up everything and address the transition into a new century. Lots of things have happened in this century, and I think it would be good for us to review them before we move on and learn even more new stuff. So, if you're interested in that, join me next time on Between the Bar Lines.